Michael Riley, Director of the Schools History Project.
Thank you. Please can you tell me about your own educational and teaching background to start with?
Sure, yeah. Well, I was brought up in the north of England, in Calderdale, and educated in state schools there. And from there went on to study history at University of St Andrews in Scotland. I say study history because, as you know, in Scottish universities you kind of study a range of subjects in your first 1 or even 2 years. And so I studied economics and psychology and various history courses in my first 2 years, and then specialised in history. So I was there for 4 years, and then from there went on to do a PhD at University of York with Professor Jim Sharp. I think I was his first PhD student, so he was pleased about that, and I was too, actually. Although it was quite isolated, I mean, I was the only one kind of working with him. And from the very beginning, really, working in an archive 5 days a week, eight hours a day, didn't suit me. So I recognised kind of within the first few weeks of doing research, archival research, that I needed social interaction. So I started teaching quite early on when doing my research, and doing some university teaching in the department at York, but mainly doing WEA teaching. And that was working with what were then termed psychogeriatrics. I'm sure that term now is totally non-PC. But they were basically people with Alzheimer's. And I did a lot of reminiscence therapy with them. So they used to call me the history man. And I worked in various, because you know, kind of York's a great centre for kind of psychiatry various psychiatric hospitals are based there. So I worked with elderly people in reminiscence therapy, and also worked with younger schizophrenics doing history around us, really. Taking them out to look at things, getting them interested, visiting medieval churches and monasteries and factories and all kinds of places. So I combined kind of teaching WEA University with my research for several years, really. Then decided I was really enjoying the teaching so much, and particularly working with younger people, that I would train to teach. And so I went to University of Leeds and worked with, my tutors were Bob Unwin and Liz Foster, and so did my PGC with them, my teaching practice at Boston Spa School. Absolutely loved it in the very beginning, everything about it, I just felt it was absolutely the right thing to be doing. But I'd had this kind of long-standing ambition to do VSO, and so immediately after my PGCE, I volunteered to teach in Tanzania and taught there for 2 years, teaching English mainly, a bit of geography, a bit of history, in a state secondary school in quite a remote part of Tanzania near the Mozambique border, a place called Songea. So my 20s were a kind of mixture of historical research, and the courses I taught really focused on early modern history, because that was the area of my DPhil, but also local history. So I taught the history of York right through from kind of Middle Ages right through to the 20th century, and very much kind of courses and teaching centred on using the historic environment. I was in two minds, because I hadn't finished writing up my PhD when we went to Tanzania, and I was in two minds whether to take all these boxes of kind of 17th, 18th century probate inventories and wills with me, and decided against that, which I think was a good move. But it meant when we came back, and I was determined to find a teaching job in a state school in England, that I hadn't finished my PhD. So That first year when we came back was tough, actually, because we came back because my wife and I were expecting our first baby, And so she was born the second week I started teaching. I came back, I found a job at Vermoyden High School in Goole. And she was born in the same week, and then we got this letter. I got a letter from the university telling me I must finish my PhD. So it's the worst year, you can imagine. First teaching job in a pretty tough school, finishing my PhD in a newborn. So it got better after that. And that was it, really. I mean, my 30s were, and into my early 40s, were teaching in state schools in this country, first of all in Yorkshire, and then we moved to Somerset 15 years ago, post as head of humanities at Buckler's Mead School in Yeovil, and then after 2 or 3 years I joined the advisory service in Somerset as humanities advisor.
So in what ways did your teaching experience from, what was it, 87 to 96?
That's right, yeah.
Influence your thinking about how history should be taught?
I think it had begun before that, really. I mean, the influences in terms of my view of how history should be taught had begun, really, while in my 20s, when I was teaching teenagers in an informal context, really, through the WEA. But they kind of crystallised doing VSO, because what kind of became really apparent to me there was the need to make it meaningful. I mean, in Tanzania, I was teaching a curriculum that at one level had very little meaning for the students, because it was a hangover from kind of the colonial times, really. I mean, our book cupboard was stocked with Shakespeare and Dickens and things, under Nyerere the curriculum had changed, and it had become, as the government perceived it, more meaningful for youngsters. But it was very much kind of Ibsen and Arthur Miller and lots of kind of anti-capitalist stuff. But the challenge there was to make the English we were doing, the literature we were doing, and the history and the geography meaningful for students. And that was a challenge teaching schizophrenic teenagers in York, and that was a challenge in my first teaching post in Goole, and ever since, really. So this desire to kind of make learning history a meaningful experience is one that's stuck with me, I think. And the importance of kind of focusing, the link to scholarship is interesting, because coming from a background in university teaching and research, and then university teaching, when I started teaching in school, the mismatch between what was going on in school and some of the exciting cutting-edge research that was going, particularly in aspects of history that I was interested in, social and cultural history, became immediately apparent. That in many ways the school history curriculum seemed to me to lag behind the kind of history that was being researched and taught in lots of university departments.
In what ways?
Overall, perhaps, in terms of the emphasis on rather traditional political history that characterised the A-level syllabuses then, and I would argue still characterise the A-level specifications, compared to some of the stuff going on in the universities. I mean, in a way, it's a two-way process, because I think much of the focus in schools, for example, on the use of the historic environment or visual sources that are kind of bread and butter to history teachers, development studies, are missing from university courses. So it's a two-way process, really. But certainly this desire to kind of create links between academic historical scholarship and what's going on in the schools very early on in my career was there, and has continued, really, ever since.
Can I ask you what sort of philosophical basis underpins that belief that there should be a connection between what goes on in universities and what goes on in schools? Some people could argue what goes on in schools is a foundation. It shouldn't be following the fashions and trends of university scholarship.
No, and I can see that. However, I think what we have, and we're lucky in history, is great clarity about what the discipline is, really. I often equate it to playing a game of football. Yesterday evening I was watching my 10-year-old play football. The previous day I'd watched Man United beat Manchester City on the box. And it is, self-evidently, the same thing that you're watching. And I've always felt that history should be like that, really. Whether history is being done by at Key Stage 1, a class of 6-year-olds, or whether it's being done by a PhD student, it is the same discipline.
But that doesn't really explain whether the schools should abandon, if you like, the bedrock and follow what the universities are doing. And obviously, universities' research tends to go in a number of different directions depending on the zeitgeist sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah. It depends what you mean by the bedrock, really, of what's going on in schools, really. And I would argue that what kind of, to me, should characterise that bedrock, whether it's in schools or in universities, is diversity. That we need to be studying a range of things, a range of people's experiences in the past, a range of periods. We need to be studying these things in a range of different ways, using a range of techniques. And that, you know, so that diversity that I think, as you describe it, underpins what might be happening in the universities, I think is equally important when you're studying history in primary schools and secondary schools.
On the issue of the meaning, making things meaningful to pupils, does that in any way contradict the aim to, if you like, reflect the advancements in historical research?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there are tensions there. But I think fundamentally the meaning is about getting to the heart of the matter in terms of people and the kind of influences on them and the moral choices they make and the ways in which they live their lives and their beliefs and attitudes in the past, and getting to the heart of that, what I think Richard Evans called the leap of imagination that all historians need, you know, whether they're 6 or 60. You know. And so I think getting to the heart of that is the critical thing. And that's what I mean by, you know, so for example, when we're studying the Black Death, which is a great topic to be teaching kind of 11, 12-year-olds, because it's full of all the gruesome, horrible history stuff that will attract them initially. And so, we, you know, as teachers, we've all stuck oranges up our jumpers, you know, pretended they're buboes and that kind of stuff. You have to go beyond that to say, where is the fundamental human understanding that I want children to develop here in terms of the Black Death, and it's about beliefs at that time, it's about the way in which, when societies are under huge pressure, minorities can become the focus of attack. You know, so the Black Death is brought by foreigners. Just as, you know, when we had the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, 1990s, the gay community became the focus of that. So that I think there are these parallels you can draw across periods of history that go beyond just studying history in itself and can help to make it more meaningful for young people. And I'd argue that, you know, that's there in lots of the best historical work as well, and the research that university historians are doing.
When you were speaking about Tanzania and about the mismatch between the syllabus and the pupils, there is an implication that different groups of pupils will have different needs in curriculum terms. So when you're talking about meaning, are you implying that for different groups of children, different curriculum would give meaning? Or would the same curriculum have the capacity to give meaning because they're simply human beings?
The latter, yeah, absolutely. That I believe fundamentally in an entitlement curriculum. I mean, it seems to me the end point of the first suggestion is that history itself is appropriate for some youngsters and not others. And I would totally and fundamentally disagree with that. You know, it seems to me that everyone, children, adults, there's this rich potential in studying history. And that an entitlement to many different types of history should underpin work with all children, really.
What was the main focus of your work as the advisor for humanities in Somerset after 1996?
Yeah, okay, well, that I had responsibility for both history and geography, which is a bit scary, the geography bit. I mean, I'd studied geography at university, but only a kind of module in geography. I'd done it to A level, and I'd always taught geography, actually, because I'd always worked within a humanities faculty. So, in some ways, that was a challenge for me. So, I had to give equal parts of my time to both history and geography. But I was fortunate that in the faculty I'd worked in Somerset, there were great geographers there, and we did work together as a faculty. And what brought us together were three things, really. A focus on whatever we were doing had to address the issues I've just been talking about, in terms of we might be studying, for example, the geomorphology of the Dorset coast, but rocks didn't do it really for any of us. It's kind of the fundamental human issues around coastal management and so on that really drove our thinking. So the faculty was called Humanities Faculty after all, and so the first principle was that whatever we were doing should be about people. And a lot of geography isn't like that. No. I met a geographer early on as an advisor called David Leet, who is really significant at the University of Newcastle, who cared passionately about geography and making it about people. And so that really informed my work, that history is about people, so is geography. Okay. The second aspect that kind of really brought the two subjects together was that they are both disciplines that fundamentally have inquiry at their heart. But it seemed to me that geographers have always been quite confused about what they mean by geography. I mean, talking to some geographers, they would interpret it as kind of field work. Whereas I think in history, we have a kind of much more inclusive view of what we mean by historical inquiry. So placing emphasis on the process of geographical inquiry and comparing that with historical inquiry really kind of underpinned my work. And I found that geographers really warmed to that, and we, you know, had some very useful projects kind of looking at historical inquiry and the way it related to the way in which geographers work and so on. And the third area was on... then it was on literacy, actually, because, as you know, we'd had during the 1990s, influenced largely by Christine Council's work, the extended writing revolution in history that hadn't really, it had begun actually to influence work in geography, but the geographers were a long way, I think perhaps because they have and had a lot more varied ways of kind of communicating, that for them extended writing was not kind of core, but it enabled me to do lots of work on literacy with geographers, and so it was those three focuses that broadened out to kind of work in communication, linking to kind of ICT and speaking and listening work. And so quite soon with my work with Somerset LEA, it kind of moved from being entirely focused on history and geography to work on whole school literacy, both oracy and reading and writing. And so that's kind of really interesting for a few years to work with science departments and DT and English and so on, a whole range of departments on whole school literacy initiatives throughout the authority.
Was there a particular programme that you were advocating that the schools use?
No, I've always hated that, actually. I've always hated the idea that there's something you can get off the shelf that's a panacea, really. So, I mean, if anything, my mantra was... interest. You know, if we want to get kids speaking and listening and writing and reading, they have to be motivated to do it. And this is why, you know, the stuff I was working on in history and geography was just heaven sent, really, because you make it about fundamental human issues, it is interesting to teenagers, you know. So that was the first kind of... And that was very, very different from the message messages we were getting from the National Literacy Strategy, actually, which were all about the technical use of language. And it seemed to me to be starting from the wrong point. You know, if you want children to be able to write complex sentences or to use semicolons proficiently, they need to be inspired to communicate about something, really. So that was the kind of first emphasis of my work in literacy, kind of giving them something meaningful. The other kind of dimensions to it were on challenge. You know, it really struck me when I started working across the curriculum that the reason why lots of children were switched off and teenagers switched off in their learning was that what they were doing in lessons wasn't sufficiently challenging. And the third area was just a range of ways in which to communicate. I think for some time in history we were kind of... we went overboard with extended writing and forgot the importance of debate, the importance of oral presentation, the importance of kind of visual in communication. So it kind of broadened out to that across the curriculum as well. So the answer is no. I kind of, you know, there were lots of things kind of, even in those, during the 1990s, there were probably about kind of at least a dozen things that lots of which had informed the National Literacy Strategy. But I never felt I could advocate any of them, really, because none of them quite did the trick.
What led to you being invited to join the QCA Working Group for History as part of the Deering Review in 1994-5?
Yes, in 4-5, yeah. Then I was teaching in Yorkshire, and I remember in 1993, it would be autumn of 1993, after John Patton had decided he would ask Deering to conduct the review. There were a series of regional conferences consulting teachers, really, because one of the principles of the Deering Review was that it should include a lot more teachers, eventually in the working groups. But initially in the regional conferences and consultations. And so I was invited by NCC or SCAR, anyway, to attend one of the regional conferences in York. I think it was Carol White who was then, she had been on the first working group, and she was then history advisor in Humberside, and she invited me to go on to the conference, and it was as a result of just expressing clear views, I think, at that conference about the way in which the curriculum might be slimmed down and at the same time improved, as I saw it, that I was invited to join some months later the National Working Group.
And what were your ideas?
It seemed to me, you know, having taught the first national curriculum, that at one level it was a brilliant document. I think the people who put the first national curriculum together did a fantastic job in terms of the balance they struck between historical knowledge, understanding and skills that were in there from the start. I think that's characterised national curriculum until the present day. And that has been an absolutely huge success, in my view. That history, the idea that history is fundamentally about knowledge, but it is also about developing and understanding of the way in which the discipline works. I think Tony McAlevey described this as the cosmic marriage between kind of key elements and as they became study units, you know. So we had that to build on. But of course, what we were faced with was three attainment targets and other levels of attainment. And we were faced with far too much prescription in terms of content that made planning and structuring learning, particularly through developing inquiry, quite difficult. So at one level, the document was not helpful in terms of planning learning for students. And so I had ideas about the way in which it could be slimmed, and yet the rigor maintained of, you know, knowledge and processes and concepts as they've now become, that I think, you know, SCAR were interested in and led them to invite me to be on their group.
Because that was the main task, wasn't it, to slim down the curriculum, make it workable.
It was. Because Patton had decided in 1993, I think, that history and geography, along with modern languages, would not be compulsory into Key Stage 4. Because you remember, obviously, that in the original national curriculum, we were going to have national curriculum history until the age of 16. So that was one element of it, that publishers were well down the route of publishing books for that curriculum. And he also retreated from the position that all 10 national curriculum subjects would have standard assessment tasks at the end of, or tests at the end of Key Stage 3. And that was kind of a double-edged thing, really, because we were greatly relieved that we didn't have that, because I think it's been the kind of death of much of English and good work in English and science, for example. But on the other hand, it undermined the status of the subject. So it's a double-edged thing. So yes, it was slimming down, but it was slimming down with a recognition that we were losing what had been planned for Key Stage 4. So we had, in a sense, it was an impossible task, because we had to claw back and put into Key Stage 3 much of the 20th century, because it was heavily dominated, Key Stage 4, in my view, too heavily dominated by 20th century history. And we had to claw that back and get it into Key Stage 3 to make an entitlement somehow. So that was quite demanding. We could slim down, but on the other hand, we had to maintain this balance of knowledge, and that became a very divisive point on the working group, the whole knowledge issue, particularly in relation to British history, and maintain the concepts and processes that were there, and claw back from what had been planned for Key Stage 4. So yes, slimming down, but it wasn't quite as kind of straightforward as that. It was a bit more complex.
And I believe you had a very short time in which to do it, is that right?
We did, certainly compared to the first National Curriculum Working Group. We met three times during the January and February of 1994, just for 2 days in London. It was totally exciting, you know, for me as I was head of department then, a school in Yorkshire, but we would get these great wadges of stuff through the post that SCAR had sent to us, with confidential stamped all over them. The person wondered what it was, and we were told we must not speak to the press. The press contacted me once or twice, and I just had to kind of say, no, not allowed to speak to you at all. Even went to the extent of we weren't told our hotel in London. We moved round each time, so the press couldn't kind of find out where we were. We weren't told the hotel until just before we were about to set off. We were given first-class rail travel so that we could read the documentation, but kind of in some degree of privacy. My left-wing friends in York thought this was absolutely terrible, you know, that I was travelling first class to London at taxpayers' expense, you know. So it was all kind of highly secretive and done in a very short timescale, partly because Patton wanted to kind of get it all sorted, and he knew the pressures that teachers were under, and that the curriculum was unworkable I think. But also because it was seen that what we had was a reasonable structure, and that was my view as well, that needed some modification and not going back to a clean slate, really. So, yeah, we just met during January and February for 2 days each.
So how many of you were there in the group?
I can't remember, actually. I would guess it's somewhere between 8, 9, 10 people.
Quite a small group.
Small group. It was chaired by Nick Tate, who was then, I think, Assistant Chief Executive, SCA. And then there were the subject officers, who, in my view, did a brilliant job, Ian Colwell and Sue Bennett. And in my view, Nick Tate did a brilliant job too. And then various people. I was amazed. I mean, there weren't all that. And it of course included primary. So we had a couple of, I think, two primary head teachers. Had a historian, Derek Fraser from University of Bradford. A Christian Council was on the Deering group. That's when I first met her. And of course, we had Anthony O'Hare and Chris McGovern. And what struck me at the first meeting was, what a range of opinion you had there, really. And how divided, potentially, this group could become. And in fact, did become. Although, actually, the only division in the end was between Chris McGovern and the rest of the group. No. Because it struck me from the very beginning that what he was arguing for was completely deluded, you know, and in terms of most teachers I knew, he was a complete maverick, really. That he was obsessed not with giving children an understanding of the discipline as a whole, with providing challenge and access and interest and making history meaningful. He was just obsessed with British history, and we must have a predominance of British history in the, as we did actually in the end, but we must have this event, these events, these people through history, you know. And he just wanted history as this great list of great British heroes and events that children must learn kind of by rote kind of thing. So yes, it was quite apparent that given that we'd got 3 2-day meetings and such divided opinion on the group, this wasn't going to be easy. I mean, to be honest, I think that I never discussed this with anyone, but clearly the SCA thinking from the start had been was better to have him in than on the outside kicking up a fuss and speaking to the press. In the end, of course, he didn't like what the group came up with, which struck me as a very sensible compromise and consensus, and produced his minority report that he published through, I think, the Campaign for Real Education. Mm. But he seemed to be going along with it for the first couple of meetings, and then, you know, lost. I think his view was that SCA were rushing it, that it there wasn't the opportunity to go back to first principles. And that we just weren't including this long list of events and people that he thought was important.
Did you spend more time on the content than looking at the attainment target?
We did, actually. There was an assumption from the beginning that because of the way in which the original programme of study had been, or programmes of study for each key stage had been framed, that we needed to maintain that structure of defining knowledge and at the same time defining what in the first national curriculum was knowledge, skills and understanding then became key elements in 1995. So that was something that we wanted to maintain and defining that. But in the end, the discussion about the attainment target, you know, I believe that took a decision on that was made within 10 minutes, you know, at the very last meeting. Because we were working under enormous pressure. I mean, it's really interesting. We were working late into the night drawing up. I mean, into the early hours, literally. Particularly the second and third meetings to draft the individual study units and so on. Meanwhile, we were hearing that, you know, Music have finished and they've all gone out to a jazz club in London or something. So we were working under this enormous pressure. But I think it was apparent to quite a few people on the group that the problem with the attainment targets was that we didn't need attainment targets, we just needed one, and we should call it history. And that was decided upon very quickly towards the end. So the bulk of the meetings was, you know, programmes of study in relation to kind of history study units and key elements, really.
Really, the content, that was the bulk of your, if you like, the content of the courses.
Yes, combined with what the key elements should be, actually, which seemed to me to be a very sensible way to approach it, and still is, I think.
So history was, you know, the most controversial subject. Did you get a lot of comment in the press at the time that affected what you were doing?
Yes, we did. When the draft report, I think, was published in May, and Chris McGovern had sent his minority report to the press at about that time, I think, there was lots and lots of press coverage, all of it completely ridiculous, and all of it fitting into what the late Rob Phillips described as the discourse of derision. You know, I mean, the press coverage was of history education then, as it is now, absolutely pathetic, really. Completely along the lines of, you know, great British heroes axed from the curriculum, you know, which we still get, which is, you know, absolute nonsense. But that was the only dimension of learning history in schools that the press was interested in. But having said that, it's perhaps the dimension of the history curriculum that politicians are most interested in, the relationship between history and national identity, and, as they see it, the need for a core of British history in the curriculum, that had generated a lot of heat in the discussions of the group, that people like Anton O'Hare and Chris McGovern felt very passionately about. In the end, I think we came out with, and I regret this really, more British history than we had in the original curriculum. I think what we did was a good job in the end in terms of striking a balance and in terms of creating greater clarity and flexibility within individual study units to give teachers the flexibility to plan. But overall, we came out with, I think, something like a balance of 75% British, 25% non-British history. People like Christine Council and I had to really fight for the non-British in there. I can remember really amusing meeting when Chris Woodhead used to kind of float around and drop in to various, because the various working groups were happening in parallel. And he used to kind of drop in to various. I think he spent a lot of time in history and English literature, as he would, English, you know, because of, you know, the political dimension to this. And he really pressed us on, surely the simplest way to slim down the curriculum is just to get rid of the non-British units. Yeah. And he, I remember him turning to me at one point and saying, but why is it that we need this non-British or non-European, a European and non-European? Why, you know, what is it? And I got quite passionate about kind of Little England and mentality and the need for children to understand the complexity of other cultures and their history and all that. So it was a real battle, even to maintain the kind of two units out of the six that were focused on non-British history, because there was a lot of pressure to slim the history down to a core of only British history.
That's the key stage three.
That's the key stage units, three. Yeah. That's I'm not talking about key stage. But, you know, it was interesting that after we produced our draft proposals, I think the only direct intervention from John Patton was at Key Stage 1, where he said that he felt we should beef up the requirement to study famous British people and British events And so, you know, that kind of political intervention was there in the later stages of the curriculum revision, as it's always there, really. Governments have, I've realised kind of in subsequent revisions since, that governments of any political persuasion are obsessed with maintaining a core of British history for a variety of reasons, I think. But that seems to really exercise them more than anything else in the history curriculum.
That is interesting. I mean, what do you think the reasons are why politicians are obsessed with British history being on the curriculum?
But, well, you know, I mean, it basically, it's self-evidently, it's about their the link they see between learning history in schools and developing a sense of national identity. And I think lots of politicians nowadays, Labour politicians, Liberal Democrat politicians as well, see that they start from a consensus point of view that if only we could all unite in Britain behind a common story. Totally ill-conceived view, in my opinion, that there is the one story, really. You know, their view, it'll all be all right, which seems terribly simplistic to me. But it is this fundamental link between national identity and school history that lies at the heart of it. And whereas my view is, my view is that British history is hugely important, and that children and young people are entitled to find out about their national history, but they're also entitled to find out about their local history. And about wider world history, other cultures and civilizations, and that we need to maintain that balance. I think probably most politicians don't share that view.
The time that you were given, as you said, was very short. So were you happy with the outcomes from the review?
Yes, broadly speaking, because, as I say, we'd maintain the balance. But I think we maintained a balance between knowledge, core knowledge, as I say, of British history, an entitlement to local history, to world history, and an entitlement to conceptual understanding and understanding of the way in which the discipline works. So I was really pleased that we'd maintain that. One of the solutions we came up with was that history should be studied in outline and depth. This was partly a pragmatic solution to the fact that we'd had to claw back so much 20th century into what inevitably, I think, would become a Year 9 course. I think that's still a problem, you know. I think that was mistaken, actually, that we ended up putting too much 20th century history into that fourth core unit, and the 20th century world became kind of impossible to study, difficult to plan for, and dominated the whole of Year 9, really, in an unhealthy way, in my view. So I regret, actually, that in a way we pandered too much to the views of Chris McGovern and Anthony O'Hare. In the end, I think Anthony O'Hare was happy with what we'd come up with, but he was very much arguing for, in the end he saw the need to maintain the balance, really, and that just because you weren't prescribing something didn't mean that it wouldn't be taught. No. So I think we created, on the whole, a workable document. I was pleased with the move to one attainment target. Generally, the responses were pretty good. I think it led to some good history teaching, really. And I think it led to greater clarity, because part of the review was defining, that we had to think really carefully about and took a lot of time, was defining the focus statement at the beginning of each history study unit. And I think that's an ongoing struggle, really, in history education, that the need for teachers to define really precisely and closely why they're going to be studying this with their students over the next term, you know. And I think we're helped with that process by defining what should be taught within each unit more closely. And by coming up with an important, what I can't remember what we called it then, but what is now called an, no, I think we called it an important statement for history. No, what are the character? Why does history matter for teenagers and children? So I think that was a good move as well.
Moving on, you were involved in the development group for History for the Gifted and Talented.
Yes,
2005-06.
Yeah.
Yes. Why was that set up by the government, do you think, and has it had an impact?
In terms of why it was set up, I think a recognition that, or rather a view from government that some children in state schools were not being stretched sufficiently, and we weren't tapping into the talent that was there. And so that's, I think it started with Excellence in Cities, really, as a specific programme linked to that. And most of the early work was in terms of the extra things that gifted and talented youngsters could be doing as kind of add-ons to the curriculum. By the time the NAGTI group, I think the Group for History was the first group to be convened, I think there was a recognition, certainly on the part of Deborah Eyre at Warwick University, who was leading the initiative then, that what these so-called gifted and talented youngsters needed was provision in their everyday lessons, if you like. And so that was the starting point for work in the history group. And really our starting point was we find it very difficult to identify gifts and talent. I've always thought it completely ludicrous, actually, the idea that you can identify gifted and talented children in history, really. And when I've done courses for gifted and talented for other people, and they've asked me to kind of establish criteria, I've always just said, you know, well, really, any student who's interested enough to come and want to do more history in greater depth, really. Seems to me those students who are just passionately interested in people in the past and are curious and ask interesting questions, those are the students kind of we need to be working with in this dimension. But very much the starting point for the NAGTI history group was what's good for so-called gifted and talented students is good for all students, really. But it was a great opportunity. We met over a couple of days, and it was a really good opportunity to look at the discipline, really, and say, what characterises high achievement in history? Now, what are the characteristics of learners who are high achievers? And so we defined that more closely. And then it was an opportunity to dig down into some of the processes and concepts and say, okay, well, what can we be doing within historical inquiry and use of historical sources? What can we be doing in terms of interpretations history and significance and developing causal understanding and changing continuity that is maybe lacking at the moment that would enable children to develop even further in terms of their understanding of history. So it was really good. I mean, one of the things that I think came out of it that has been really influential is, specifically and tangibly, Arthur Chapman and Christine Council pulled together materials for the NAGTI website focused on history education that I think were really useful. There was a whole edition of Teaching History dedicated to gifted and talented that came out of the work that the group had done to spread the word, really, in terms of what the thinking was. And I think that's generated over the last few years a whole raft of teacher thinking and planning and sharing that's been really helpful in these various dimensions. We've continued to take forward our understanding of what we mean by teaching interpretations of history, historical significance, certainly independent inquiry. For me, that was a really fundamental part of the thinking that happened, because a lot of what my work to that point had been around structuring inquiry questions as planning tools for learning. it certainly moved my thinking on to think to how can we structure learning so that young people are developing their own inquiry questions, what kind of knowledge frameworks they need to be able to do that, and so on. So I think we've seen a raft of articles in teaching history that's been helping with that question really over the last few years. So I think it sparked off lots of debate, discussion, teacher planning and experimentation that's been really fruitful, but not for a very narrow group of so-called gifted and talented pupils, really, just for everyone.
So you're saying those ideas that were developed in that project really became integral to the latest revisions to the
absolutely
national curriculum?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just put one example in terms of independent inquiry that was really rude. And also, a fundamental aspect of the latest revision, 2008 revision of Key Stage 3, was the need to develop a whole range of real and creative forms of communication in history. And that work directly came out of the NAGTI group, I think.
What do you mean by real and creative forms of communication?
Okay, well, the kind of things that historians and other people with an interest in history do to communicate. That, in many respects, I mean, my personal view, probably the view of the NAGTI group, was that traditionally in school history, we have, and certainly in the way in which it's assessed at GCSE and A level, we have a very limited range of forms of communication. Basically at A level, essay writing and answering kind of paragraphs on sources and using your own knowledge and so on. And that's far too limited. And so other real outcomes are things like 101 things that you can do in terms of planning an exhibition, which historians you're going to invite, what briefing papers you're going to give, putting together PowerPoint presentations, taking part in debates, becoming historians and taking part in conferences and discussions, various forms of writing for real contexts. As a result of the work we did in the NAGTI group, I've then worked with some students to write for the BBC History magazine, those kind of things, creating websites and, you know, the whole range of things that giving lectures. We had students giving a Year 7 group giving short lectures to a year an A-level group and so on. So a whole range of ways in which kids can communicate and to kind of mirror in some way in which academic historians communicate through lectures, through articles, through books, through making history documentaries, and museum educators and on-site educators will and documentary filmmakers will choose to communicate. So I think we need that. It goes back to my earlier points about kind of the need to bring school history, popular history, academic history together in that way, really, because it enriches each aspect, I think.
You've mentioned the recent revision to the History National Curriculum for 11 to 14-year-olds. What did you really want to achieve with that revision? What was the aim, really?
Well, the starting point was another slimming down. in some ways, the starting point was less clear. And, of course, it only applied... This wasn't a national curriculum revision. It stemmed from Tomlinson. Actually, that on 14 to 19, this is my understanding anyway, that it stemmed from that, and it stemmed from the view, Tomlinson's view, that one of the issues around lack of achievement in English and maths at GCSE was the fact that the curriculum at Key Stage 3 was too overcrowded. No. So the starting point for that revision was pretty negative, actually. I mean, the rot set in on this. I remember a dreadful day in, I think, 1997, 1998, when David Blunkett decided that we were to have a national literacy and numeracy strategy, and there would be a literacy hour and a literacy and a numeracy hour that would dominate the whole morning in primary schools. And my heart sank at this point, because we'd had this kind of flourishing of history during the 1990s, really, in primary schools. Primary teachers really getting to grips with what the discipline was, how you planned through inquiry, how it wasn't just a case of doing a topic on the Tudors, but actually know, we need to be developing some conceptual understanding and understanding of inquiry through this. And we'd had this great renaissance, and then really that decision to focus on literacy and numeracy killed it. And it was the same really here, where the driving force of the curriculum and the revision of the Key Stage 3 curriculum was the need to include literacy and numeracy, which, as we well know, in terms of literacy, can be done through studying history well. Given that, the meetings were amazingly upbeat and positive, because by that stage we knew that there was so much kind of fresh thinking and improved pedagogy that we could build into the curriculum structure to make it clearer to teachers and easier for teachers to plan challenging, exciting, accessible history. So the 2008 review seemed much kind of certainly more relaxed than the Deering review, not half as kind of formal, really. They were almost like kind of seminars where...
How many people were involved in the 2008 one?
Probably the same number, actually, about 10 people. We split up into small groups to develop kind of certain aspects of the programme of study. But we spent a lot of time working on the importance statement again, a lot of time defining the breadth of study, because very early on we recognised that history study units needed to go, and we wanted to increase the flexibility of teachers to plan in their own ways by taking away the study units and defining breadth of content in terms of strands of history. We still felt we needed to provide an entitlement to knowledge. But we wanted to reduce the prescription even further. Well, we had to, because we were meant to kind of slim down the curriculum. So, but we used that, I think, to the advantage of history in terms of creating flexibility, but also coherence, defining what history is about, clarifying the key elements. Those had to be turned into concepts and processes, because every curriculum subject had to have concepts and processes. We were perfectly happy with the key elements, which we thought were workable with a bit of tweaking to kind of bring them up to date in terms of what had gone on since. But we had to change them. Some subjects really struggled because they've never had concepts and processes. In history, we were seen, I think, by QCA as kind of paragons, really, because in history... from the very outset, we had a subject defined in terms of knowledge, but also in terms of concepts and processes. So for us, it was a relatively straightforward task to kind of mould that into a programme of study. And we spent our time doing really interesting things, like increasing the clarity about why history was important in the curriculum, trying to define the content, trying to improve the way in which concepts and processes could be described, to recognise the change in thinking, the improvements that have gone in history education in the intervening period. So it was an entirely enjoyable task, really.
Did you still have depth and outline as features?
Yes. And we tried to increase the kind of sophistication, the way in which we can think about that as history educators, because in some respects in 1995 that had been pretty crass, and it was brought in as a solution to the Key Stage 4 issue that I described earlier. You know, that we're dragging all this 20th century history back to Key. What's the solution? You can't possibly study at all. Okay, well, we study some things in outline and some things in depth. And I think that the intervening work that had gone on, you know, thinking of Dale Banham and others and so on, really thinking about the relationship between depth and outline in history, had been hugely influential. And we were able to build on that by encouraging teachers to think about outline and depth, and the way in which they can be brought together across a programme of study as a whole, but also within individual inquiries, and the various complex ways in which outline and depth history can kind of work together, really. Yeah, so no, that you're right, it was a good example of the way in which, in a sense, the way in which the curriculum could be redefined was taking cognizance of the great work that teachers and history educators have done in the meantime. Yeah.
So how long did that review take? Was it rather longer than the Deering one?
Rather more spaced out. I don't think we had more meetings, though. But again, it was very interesting to come back to the issue of British history. Because here we had again, this time a Labour government interfering in exactly the same way in this process. And it was very interesting that when we... I can't remember the exact nature of the drafts we came up with, but just to give you an example of this, it was... It seemed to us that we needed one very strong strand on political change in Britain, or the nature of political power in Britain. I think it was something like the changing nature of political power in Britain from the Middle Ages through to present day. Okay? And so that was our main British political strand, and then we had another strand along the lines of the changing everyday lives and beliefs and attitudes of people, of British people. So we had some units, or some strands rather, defined as British, and I think we had about six strands in the end, but we were very happy with this kind of core British strand, political strand. When it came back after going to politicians, and there were kind of rumours that Brown himself had had a view on this, that we needed, we had to have a UK strand in there. So we ended up with, the development of political power from the Middle Ages to 20th century, including changes in the relationship between rulers and ruled over time, and changing relationships between Crown and Parliament, and development of democracy. So the British aspect really beefed up there. And then we also had the different histories and changing relationships through time of the peoples of England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, which we had kind of assumed was part of the political development of Britain. You know, but these were given that in the end we just had how many? Five, six, seven strands, and I think we'd created six, and we'd created six without this demarcation between British history and then European and world history. We hadn't kind of divided them in that way. We just had six strands. I think some of which were, I think three of which were British. So again, it was very interesting to see. Through the department, through QCA, but ultimately from politicians, that kind of political interference in the way in which the history curriculum was being constructed, and it worked too. Given that we were trying to take out specific references to content, we ended up rather ironically having to put back it, or rather put in for the first time, things like specific references to the British Empire, and even within that the transatlantic slave trade. So it was very odd to us that we were meant to be kind of stripping out content, defining history in terms of the broad strands, themes that might be studied, but the political imperative was to put in these specific references to British history, and then to specific aspects of British history. I mean, I was at one level perfectly happy to include a requirement to study the British Empire, because I think it's a hugely missing dimension in the curriculum, and it should be studied. But it seemed to me that intellectually, it doesn't really hold up to try to define the curriculum in terms of broad themes, and then to drop in one or two specific items of content.
Mm-hmm. But those were specifically asked for by the...
That was my understanding. That was my understanding, yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Just moving on to a number of issues, actually, that arise from your published work. I noticed that you published a series of books about the minds of people in the past.
Yes.
And I wondered, you know, why you thought there was a need for books that were about mentalities.
Yeah. Yeah, that in a way that goes right back to where I started in terms of bringing school history, or rather bringing latest research by academic historians into school history. So some of the stuff that I'd studied at university kind of many years ago now, I think still hasn't found its way into the school curriculum in terms of history of mentalities and social and cultural history. But what we're trying to do in the series goes beyond that into developing an understanding of fundamental human issues, that we wanted to get across the idea that history is about real sentient human beings living through a given moment in time now, and a move away from history as abstraction. And it seemed to us, because it wasn't my series. Initially, it was Christian Council's series. We worked together on it as general editors. And then Jamie Byron came in, who's hugely influential in helping to kind of give direction to the series. That was one thing we wanted to do. There are lots of things we wanted to do in the series, but that was one of them. And why we kind of very soon settled on the idea of history is about this leap of imagination to kind of get into the minds of people in the past. So that was why it had the title it did. But we're also trying to do lots of other things with it in terms of, as we termed it, re-enthroned narrative, because we thought that lots of children were actually struggling with history, because in many classrooms, supported by lots of textbooks that were available at the time, history becomes something of a parlour game, you know, spotting historical bias in sources at 100 metres, really, kind of meaningless source exercises. A lot of that going on, and a lot of meaningless empathetic work that we wanted to move away from, to kind of real empathetic work in the way I've described. So is that. And there was also a desire to move away from the classic double page spread. We saw one way to really embed historical inquiry in school history was to have to embed that in textbooks through having units of study, if you like, that lasted for 10, 12, 14 pages, really, each focused on an important historical issue and inquiry that students could really get their teeth into, really, and could pursue and make up their own minds on within a really strong knowledge framework. So we're trying to do lots of things, really, in that series, and I think it was it sold very well. It was very well reviewed, and I think it influenced quite a lot of practice, really, and we got very positive feedback about it, really.
Another theme, obviously, has been identity and cultural encounters. How should history address the issue of identity in modern Britain? We talked about national identity, but obviously identity is a much more complex issue.
Yeah, quite. And I think I was influenced on this by reading Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize winner, and his view that one of the problems in the modern world is that identities are too singular. People are identified as a Muslim, a Westerner, what we need is to give people a sense of their multiple identities. And a way to kind of reduce violence in the world and increase kind of harmony is to give people the stronger sense that they are not defined by one thing only, you know, that I can be a straight person who supports gay rights, who is a Muslim, who is married to a Christian, who, you know, this complexity that makes up the modern world. And I think that history has a huge role to play in developing that understanding of multiple identities and complexity. And what I have been struck by and disappointed by, really, in terms of history in Britain is the way in which we continue to exclude lots of groups from their and our history, really. I remember a trainee teacher of mine saying that she was born and brought up here. Her parents were from the Punjab. And we were doing, we're doing some work on... Thanks, Nicola.
You sure?
Fine. Yeah, I remember a trainee teacher of mine, this is about 3 years ago, her parents, born in the Punjab, she had been born in this country and educated in this country. And we were doing some work on the PGC course using the Mughal Empire as a kind of context of the work. I don't think it was focused on diversity, it was focused on planning and inquiry and so on. It was just using this. And I deliberately chosen to use this because I thought it would be unfamiliar territory to. And she was really fascinated, of course, she would be in this. And it led to a discussion among the trainees of kind of what kind of Indian history they'd studied at university. And she said, despite her heritage, all the way through primary school, secondary school, and her history degree in this country, not only has she not studied any Indian history, she'd never been offered it. Mm. Can you imagine? I thought there's something seriously wrong. If one of our largest minorities in this country, the Asian community, are not within the formal education system given the opportunity to study the history of the Indian subcontinent, there's something seriously wrong somewhere. And when we were doing the work on teaching emotive and controversial issues in history from through the Historical Association, one of the things that Penelope Harnett at UWE had suggested I read, because I was working on the Key Stage 3 part of that, was a PhD thesis that she had been external for by Kay Trail at the Institute of Education London. And it was on a fascinating a PhD thesis on the attitudes of African Caribbean youngsters and their mums to the history curriculum. And what came across was their alienation. The very point at which they were supposed to be, it was their history, the leftover black peoples, the Americas unit, which always seemed quite odd to me, the lack of British focus there. They described themselves sitting at the back of the classroom absolutely incensed by the way in which their ancestors were being described and the kind of language that was used in the classroom. So this seems to me now, a really important issue. How do you provide for the multiple identities that people have and let them see that the history of the other, as it were, is invariably their own history as well, because through time the other has had encounter with the native culture, as it were. So I'm fascinated by these kinds of, in a historical context, the kind of early British Empire relationship between Elizabethan people in the 17th and 18th centuries who were engaging with different world cultures, sometimes for the first time, all that dimension, as well as the history of diverse cultures within late 20th century Britain. I think we need to kind of open up the history, as it has been actually in recent years, but I think there's some way to go still in terms of a recognition of the importance of studying migration and cultural encounter through time. I mean, what could be more important in the 21st century?
But that wasn't something that was talked about in the Key Stage 3 revision, was it?
Yes, it was actually. One particular part of the most recent Key Stage 3 revision that we felt was really important was the need to study diverse cultures and so on. So it comes across in the way in which the content's defined. For example, one strand is, quoting here from the order, the impact through time of the movement and settlement of diverse peoples to and from within the British Isles. And then we have the way in which the lives, beliefs and ideas of people in Britain have changed over time. And finally, the development of trade, colonisation, industrialisation, technology, the British Empire and its impact on different peoples in Britain and overseas.
That was something the politicians were perfectly happy with.
Yes, yeah.
But they hadn't specifically asked for it.
As far as I'm aware, not. No, no.
Because it's the sort of complement to the idea of national identity.
Yes, it is. And I think there's a recognition of that. Though it's interesting that, for example, the only national museum on the British Empire in Bristol closed down a couple of years ago. Mm. I hope it re-emerges somewhere. It seemed to me Bristol was a good place for it, but, you know. I think, I mean, a lot of my work